Daniel Malachuk, it is a pleasure to meet you this morning.
Pleasure to meet you.
We have, our paths have not crossed before, and that's a shame, because you are a professor of English at Western Illinois University, the Quad Cities campus, and I understand that your specialty is transcendentalism. Is that right?
That is correct.
How did you happen to get into that field?
Long ago, in graduate school, I was just drawn initially to Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah, he is a guy, isn't he?
He is a guy, and he's one of the big three of the American Transcendentalists, along with Henry David Thoreau and Margaret Fuller.
Yeah, you didn't put Walt Whitman in there. Why?
That's a very good question. He certainly was affiliated with them. He was a great admirer of Emerson's work in particular, but he was based in the New York City area, and as opposed to the three I mentioned who were based around Boston. Yeah. And so a lot of his concerns are similar, but he was really operating as his own figure.
Yeah, he was pretty much his own guy.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's Emerson, one of Emerson's quotes. I don't like quotes. Tell me what you think. Okay. That is an interesting term, transcendentalism. What exactly do you take it to mean?
That is indeed the question for me. That was, in fact, what drew my interest to it. The American Transcendentalists were ironically made famous, at least in the American universities, for almost all of their qualities except their transcendentalism. So while popularly they are understood as transcendentalists, in the academic world, it was really their bold statements related to individuality, feminism, environmentalism, abolitionism, that drew critics to them, rightly so on all of those counts. But what my main work has been as a scholar is to what I call re-transcendentalize the American Transcendentalists, to show how, with all of those concerns, the driving impetus was their conviction that all of us have God within. And that really changes the overall philosophy, both political and beyond, when you recall that this was essentially a religious movement as opposed to a secular movement.
That almost sounds something like Hinduism, that there is a God within you. Mm-hmm. And your job or obligation or what you ought to do is to draw the God out and express it in your actions. Not a bad idea, really.
No, it's not. I completely agree. And among their accomplishments, Emerson and Thoreau in particular were among the very first readers of Hinduism in the United States.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they put together a collection of excerpts from various non-Western religions in the Dial, which was for a few years their journal that they published along with Margaret Fuller, who edited it. And so you're right on the mark with that observation, that fundamental belief that if all of us have God within, we have an ethical commitment to both protect other people and help them cultivate their gifts.
The only reason I knew that is because one of my doctors is a Hindu, and we spent some time talking about it one day.
Okay.
And I thought, that's kind of an interesting concept.
Yeah.
And here we have transcendentalism right here at home.
Yes.
That is fascinating. But how did you happen to get, where do you come from? How did you happen to get into English and all this?
Right.
I mean, who majors in English? Come on.
Yes, that is unfortunately a big question today. I did major in English back in the late 1980s at a place called Bowdoin College in
Maine. Oh yeah, and very Boston-ish.
Yes, though I myself am not. I'm originally from the Washington D.C. area, but I was very excited to move up to the Northeast. I love that part of the country, and that's where I spent a lot of time. Though I did my graduate work at Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey. And that's where I was introduced to Transcendentalism, actually. I had been more focused on the British Victorians before then. And really, ever since then, I've been studying those three authors particularly. And I came out to Western Illinois University, the Quad City campus, in 2007, initially to help them begin a major in the liberal arts and sciences, which is still going. And then around 2010, we began the English major at the WIU-QC campus as well.
Uh-huh.
And it remains a vibrant major, and I've been very happy to be working there. I really like my students and my colleagues.
You know, I read a lot about various things, but one article that caught my eye is somebody was saying, we really need more English majors. We have all these sciences and no one knows how to talk and how to write, yeah, how to express themselves. And command of language is pretty essential if you want to communicate anything.
Of course. Yeah, it's funny that you mention it. Just last night, a colleague of mine sent an article from the Washington Post that was about this very topic, where they pointed out we actually need more English majors to help us tell our stories, that we have a lot of facts, but we don't really know what to make of them. And if you think of how much of our lives are driven by narratives that people repeat to themselves, particularly sometimes narratives that can grow somewhat poisonous in their thinking about other people, you realize how important it is to have English majors and others who are familiar with literature and the other arts to be able to tell counter narratives that can help to bring us together. This article also pointed out, which I didn't know, but I've seen things like this, that actually it's somewhat of a myth that English majors make less money than those who major in the STEM majors. Mm-hmm. So if we must talk about those kinds of things, there's actually no financial advantage, a significant one at least, to not major in English.
One of the things that knocks me out is those who major in the classics seem to have the best employment record of all.
Is that true?
That's amazing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of facts like that out there that kind of get lost. Speaking of narratives, I mean, that has become a common narrative that we need to be a society that's wholly dedicated to the STEM. And of course that's important, but you know, all of these scientific tools and technology tools, to what end? You know, that's actually an idea that comes from both Thoreau and Walden and somewhere in Emerson, but this idea that, I think it's Thoreau who says something about, we've built a transatlantic cable, but what are we going to say to each other?
Yeah, that's true.
That's getting at this.
You know, there's a new book out by Rachel Maddow, who drives me crazy when I watch her on TV because she takes forever to get to the point.
Yes.
But her book is just a marvel of research and eloquence. She talks about the pervasive influence of oil and gas,
right,
and how it absolutely controls the whole world. And as you read this, you think, yes, it does, and I don't know that we can do anything about it.
Right.
But one aspect of it, she points out how Russia has put everything on oil.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, they were trapped by the sanctions that were put on them, that our president is desperately trying to undo.
Mm-hmm.
But with those sanctions, they can't get to the oil,
right,
on the northern part of Siberia. And their spy system is so ineffective that there's a humorous bit about, you know, how we track and record all their spies. But they found out that by going on the internet, they can absolutely disrupt the entire world.
Right.
And they have this big place, I forget the avenue it's on, works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bright young people come there to work, and they have to learn enough about America to be able to disguise themselves as concerned Americans.
Right.
And there's one marvelous incident where they were working from the right and the left. They were able to bring a mob together around a mosque in somewhere in Texas.
Oh, dear.
Both sides were roused on the internet by these fake people. You think, my Lord.
Yeah. These are really good points. One of the favorite words of English professors is imagination. In fact, one of the most important books in American Transcendentalist Studies in the last 20 years or so was a book called The Environmental Imagination by a professor, he's retired now, who was at Harvard, Lawrence Buell. And in that book, he argues with Thoreau sort of as the initial figure that there's an entire tradition in both American literature and beyond about thinking of our relationship to the environment in a different way than the exploitative, extraction-oriented relation that we've been dedicated to, thanks to the fossil fuels and the narratives that we, you know, spin around those. So this is one of the values of studying English, is we can, by looking at older writers, recover these different ways of understanding our relationship to, in this case, the environment, which obviously, at least from my point of view, is a crucial reorientation that has to happen. What we've been doing is not working. You know, California is on fire, and there's just going to be more and more of these kinds of crises unless we can understand ourselves in a different way in our relationship to nature. And so the facts aren't going to change people's minds about that. It's really going to be the stories that we tell that people find satisfying and fulfilling about how we would relate to nature. And that's been one of the most important areas of transcendentalist research in the last 20 years or so, has been actually thinking about them not just as the prophets of individuality, which is what they're more famous for, but also as prophets of an environmentalism that we're still in need of.
Mm-hmm. Isn't transcendentalism on the religious side kind of a pantheism, mm-hmm. God in nature?
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't that drive the established religions crazy?
Well, yes, possibly. I mean, I like to think of the transcendentalists as generous readers of our relationship to God and the universe, and opening up connections with other denominations. But yes, that, you know, these sectarian issues, and this is one of the things that kind of drove the transcendentalists even out of Unitarianism, which was, you know, then and now one of the most progressive and open of denominations. But they even found those restrictive in their effort to, you know, in the spirit of that collection of non-Western writings I mentioned earlier, to find ways that we could all actually work together with a set of common faiths that would actually, you know, it would be a place of overlapping consensus among people.
How do you get driven out of Unitarianism?
Well, it was a little more restrictive at the time. I think nowadays the Unitarians are very happy to claim all three of them as a part of their larger religious family. But at the time, it was a little bit more restrictive.
It is interesting how things do evolve.
Yes.
You know, it's not just our bodies, but our society. Everything evolves. The problem with humans is our evolution is so slow.
Yeah.
So very slow. Whereas the bacteria, in a minute, can give you several generations, change, and become lethal enough to kill you.
That's right.
It's a fascinating world. It really is. And it's one thing to examine. I've always been in love with science all my life. But it's one thing to study and begin to understand. But then it's quite another thing to transmit that information. Edward O. Wilson is I think, the great scientist of our time, and he writes well, mm-hmm. which is a blessing.
Right.
Because in order to convey to people the truth about things, you have to be able to communicate. And that means you must use language.
Right.
And I don't know, are you making any headway?
In my small way with my students and colleagues, I hope so. I certainly enjoy working with them. You know, one of the attractions of the Transcendentalists from that point of view is they were masters of a literary form that's not often talked about as much as, say, novels, which is the essay.
Oh, yeah.
And the essay is an interesting literary form in that it allows in a relatively small space for a writer to explore. It comes from the French word essay, to try, to explore different approaches to a topic. And to me, that's always been one of their great gifts, along with other essayists, of course, but their ability to experiment with different perspectives over the course of, say, 10 to 15 pages, which also leads to a lot of debate about which of those perspectives are ultimately the one that they're endorsing. But it does, just to study one essay by any of these three Transcendentalists is an education in itself because of all the different perspectives that it will take. For example, you brought up how slow we are to change. Emerson wrote an essay called The Conservative, and he's generally associated with the progressive wing of American thought. But it's in many ways a tribute to how we also need to conserve ideas, and that these two things must work in tandem with each other. But it's an essay that veers back and forth between those two positions. Sometimes it sounds like he's completely committed to a conservative perspective, and then other times to a progressive perspective. And it's all thanks to his ability to use the essay that he can explore that.
You know, you need those two poles.
Yeah.
You absolutely have to have true conservatives, mm-hmm. and you absolutely have to have liberals.
Right.
And the dialogue between them is what enables us to move and change and develop.
Exactly.
But we're in trouble on the conservative end right now.
Yeah.
And we need to help cultivate conservatism.
Yeah.
Just in order to try to put things in balance. And it's hard to do because things have turned so radical, so far left, so far right. It's hard to get people to talk to one another.
Yeah. Well, this is another interest of this period, is the American Transcendentalists were working during what may hopefully will remain the most poisonous period in American politics, the 1850s. You know, just before the Civil War.
That led war, uh-huh.
And it was so poisonous that there was vast swaths of things written in the Northeast that nobody in the South could read because of restrictions, legal restrictions that the Congresses had passed to keep that material out of the hands of people. And if you think about today, we've kind of inflicted the same problem on ourselves because we both sides live in their own bubble. And there's very little dialogue in between. And I don't know if the Transcendentalists have much to offer. I mean, they wrote powerfully, really among some of the most powerful demands for justice for enslaved people. But it didn't work.
Yeah.
None of it worked. None of it worked. And Lincoln, another great writer and speaker, tried his best, and it didn't work. So there's a nasty lesson from the 1850s that if we don't learn how to speak to each other and to listen to each other, problems can arise. And that's where, again, I think this the earlier thing we were talking about, this telling different stories about ourselves so that we can understand ourselves as not, the demonizing that we do on both sides is really a place that literature could help us to become a little bit more nuanced in the way we approach that.
It's really hard because right now, I don't know, it's easy to blame the Russians for this because mm-hmm. they have been masters at, and they, it's almost as if they don't care which side it's on, except in certain narrow political things. They just want to get us at each other's throats and not listen to one another and have not only facts, but alternate facts. I mean, it's just crazy.
It is.
It's just crazy. Years ago, I did a radio program with Bert Metcalf, who was, you know, roundly condemned by the Democrats as this diehard conservative right-wing. Delightful fellow. And he and I used to sit down for 15 minutes every week and talk about stuff. He had a profound influence on me, and I had an influence on him. We were friends, and we could talk about across differences of opinion and try to work to something that seemed to make sense to both of us. That's the way to do it.
It is.
And since Newt Gingrich arrived in Congress and proved that by being nasty you can win, all bets are off. It's funny how one man can have such a profound influence.
Yes, but, you know, we're all to blame in giving in to the, you know, our lesser parts of ourselves, you know,
well,
instead of our better angels.
It's so much easier to do.
Yeah.
When you have to think, you know, the brain uses 20% of the body's energy, but when you try to think about stuff, it goes up to 25%. It's just too much work. Scientists have all this fascinating information about how it works. I'm talking to Dan Malachuk, who's a professor of English at Western Illinois University here in the Quad Cities. And we're not done yet, but we do have to make room right now for the composer's date book. Oh, back to our conversation with Dan Malachuk. You know, Emerson is one of the most quotable people around. And one of the things, one of the quotes I especially like is, one of the blessings of old friends is that you can be stupid with them. To relax and just not worry. That is a blessing of old friends.
Absolutely.
They don't expect you to always be on the mark all the time.
Right.
But he also talks about, you know, don't follow another trail. Go where others have not gone and leave a path.
Right.
That's is a great statement on individualism. What do you think is the center of all the stuff he writes?
Well, you could make a good case that that would be it. That his most famous essay is called Self-Reliance. That is the essay, 1841, that is most often referred to when people refer to Emerson. And it's the really the great statement of nonconformity in American literature. The particular part of it that I believe is important often gets overlooked. And if you don't mind, I have like
a
moment from that essay. It's a great example of what I was saying earlier about how essays take you on a journey. And in this case, there actually are 50 paragraphs in this essay. And along the way, he visits many different perspectives. There's a notorious paragraph. I think it's the seventh. I'm a little rusty on this, but this is the one where he says, "Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist." And I say it's a notorious paragraph because it's in that paragraph that he talks about, if an abolitionist comes to my door preaching abolition, how he would turn them away in order not to be forced into any kind of political perspective. And so this is sort of the uglier side of nonconformity.
Oh, yeah.
And some people have, you know, dwelt on that and said, this is what Emerson was really all about. But, you know, my rebuttal to that would be, that's paragraph 7, and there's 43 more paragraphs to go. And where the essay ultimately ends up, I think, is also where it begins, with the beginning of paragraph 3 says, "Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. Accept the place the divine providence has found for you. And it's this transcendental understanding of oneself. In fact, he used to talk about self-reliance in earlier drafts of the essay, as well as in some sermons when he was actually a Unitarian minister. He called it God-reliance.
God what?
God-reliance. God-reliance. Not yeah. self-reliance.
Mm-hmm.
And then, notably, he comes back to that same way of putting it in one of his addresses against slavery. He returns to that phrase, God-reliance. So bookending this very famous essay from 1841 on self-reliance is this career-long understanding of self-reliance is actually turning to that inner God. And this returns us to that opening conversation we had, which is that self-reliance does not mean a selfishness or egotism or anything like that. It means a kind of recognition of yourself as connected and part of everybody else. And so for a long time, a problematic aspect of Emerson's career was, how did this person who advocated individuality on one hand become such a advocate for abolition at a time when it was not a popular position, even among New England progressives, to be a full abolitionist, which meant the immediate ending of slavery? How did someone committed to, you know, individuality and anti-slavery, how did those two things work together? But to me, transcendentalism is the answer. When you remember that one's commitment to oneself is also a commitment to the selves of other people because of this godlike commonality that we share, abolition is the natural outgrowth of that kind of individuality.
But, you know, growing up down south and at about the age of six or so, realizing that segregation was a monstrosity, it was just horrible, and then having to live in that.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize you could not talk to people about this, that if you offered the, I thought, quite reasonable statement that we're all the same, no. Mm-hmm. And they could not even address the subject. Because to do so would just be to tear the fabric of society apart completely. And I don't know how you do that, how you building bridges across. The thing that surprised me about Obama when he came to the Illinois Senate,
mm-hmm.
he spent his time with people who were absolutely 180 degrees away from where he was and worked and worked and worked to relate to them, to spend time with them, mm-hmm. to get along with them. And I thought, now that is characteristic of the greater saints, I think, to try to do something like that. Mm-hmm. But that would seem to me that's an obligation we all have. Somehow you can't have a society if you can't communicate, if you can't talk across divisions. And we are having real trouble doing that right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. And there's a few ways to come at that. One would be the fine tradition of comity that I think Obama was exemplifying. You know, this idea of our political leaders learning to work with each other across the aisle. And I think there was, I don't remember his name, but there was somebody recently at Elijah Cummings' funeral from
yes.
the Republican side who spoke movingly about his friendship with him and how there needed to be more of that coming together, even among people who completely disagreed on the issues. And you know, in a way that's, I said there's a couple ways to come at this. That is, in effect, a version of what Emerson meant. This is how he squared individuality with abolitionism, is one can have different perspectives and, of course, be their own person, but you're always remembering this sort of common human connection that we have, you know, and that our opinions are just one thing, but then there's this deeper, you know, vibration that's going on between us as fellow human beings. He talks, you know, just to get a little bit Whitman-esque, because Whitman's much more of the poet on this. Somewhere Emerson writes about, it's probably in one of his essays about friendship or love, he talks about the language of these wandering eyeballs, where he's talking about, you know, there can be things that are being said, but then there's what's actually happening with people, you know, when they make eye contact. And it's that other register that, you know, friendships are such a orchestra of, you know, all these different ways that people are connecting where nothing is actually being said about it. And that's what I think is, you know, the great politicians, the one who try and work across the divide, they're good at connecting with people, even when their opinions are you know, completely opposite. The contribution that the transcendentalists might make to this the situation, this is a little bit more feisty. And of course, by, if I say feisty, that means you have to turn to Thoreau, who is really the feistiest of the three. You know that famous essay, Civil Disobedience.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's so many valuable things about that. One is just his, kind of libertarian rejection of taxes that people always remember. But to me, what matters most, again, thinking of these guys as essayists who are working through problems, they'll take various positions and then they ultimately reach a kind of tentative conclusion. His conclusion at the end of that essay, I'll just read you a sentence or two from it. He writes about the progress from an absolute to a limited monarchy, from a limited monarchy to a democracy, is a progress toward a true respect for the individual. Is a democracy, such as we know it, the last improvement possible in government? Is it not possible to take a step further toward recognizing and organizing the rights of man? And he goes on a little bit more about that, about imagining a state at last which can afford to be just to all men and to treat the individual with respect as a neighbor. It's this idea of whatever else happens that we attach ultimate value to the individual. And one problem with democracy for Thoreau, and it's hard to say these things because, you know, what's the alternative to democracy that we know? None of them are good.
Is that
Churchill's line or somebody's line? You know, one attraction of democracy is it's better than all the other options. But Thoreau's trying to compel us to imagine some next stage where whatever pressures we feel to be part of a majority or a minority, we always remember that what matters most are the rights of that individual.
Yeah.
And it's mm-hmm. it's a difficult thing to imagine. It's more poetic than policy, but that's what I mean about, you know, in literature being a repository of these amazingly imaginative stories that really nudge us to try to think beyond in this case, just the majority rules. That's what he was objecting to. The majority was in support, in that essay, what he's objecting to is the majority was in support of slavery. And how do we get beyond that? He refused to pay his taxes because they were going to go towards supporting the expansion of slavery into the Southwest through the Mexican War. But the philosophical takeaway of that is this commitment to the individual, which is way beyond what I think we're usually ready to make. That's another way to think about how we could get beyond our differences, is a kind of common commitment to the individual.
Yeah, you know, people throw around stuff about taxes. Taxes are what make democracy possible. I mean, if we all give according to our means, right. You know, your sliding scale and so on,
yes.
Then democracy is possible.
Absolutely.
The idea that cutting taxes is the holy grail, I think it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And yet we celebrate that. You know, I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Yeah. I don't either.
It's one of the crazier ideas that's come along.
Yeah.
And because it appeals to greed, and if you can appeal to something like greed, you're going to win.
Can I say one thing about that? There's a few places where the transcendentalists, I think, are not as useful. And one of their challenges reading them is, at the time they were writing, government was not on the side of justice.
Yeah.
And it's Margaret Fuller unfortunately died before this happened. Thoreau unfortunately died the year that it happened. But when Abraham Lincoln declared the Emancipation Proclamation, Emerson wrote in his journal and then almost a month later gave an address that he basically said, the federal government is now on the side of the just. And sure, it's been on the side of injustice here and there since, but large term, that was the turning point. And from then on, I'm completely in agreement with you, taxes have been supporting, you know, some flawed version of justice, and that's why we pay it. It's to work towards a better union. Prior to that, though, these writers were working with a state that was implicitly and sometimes explicitly in support of slavery. So Thoreau's anti-taxation is, you know, as it you have to think of it more as like he didn't want to be taxed to support like the Nazi Germany. That would be a more appropriate way to remember him, not as kind of like our first anti-tax philosopher who we should still respect in that regard, because he was against tax in support of a very different state than the one that comes from 1862 on once Lincoln makes the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, because if you don't support taxes, then money will rule you.
Right.
Great concentrations of money will rule you, and there's nothing you can do about
it. Yeah, we know all about that now, right?
Oh, yeah. About Fuller. We don't hear anything about Fuller.
Yeah.
She is, of the three you mentioned, she is the one that we know least about. Yet, wasn't she the editor of the Dial, or wasn't she central to that publication?
She was, and it's a shame, but it's also understandable how this has happened. I mean, one reason it's happened is just the usual problem within the study of American literature and really all literature. There's been a kind of a delay in recognizing the contributions of women authors. And that started to change in the modern academy in the 1970s when all sorts of female American authors started to work their way into the canon. And there's really remarkably little scholarship about them before the 1970s and then afterwards. In the case of, say, someone like Willa Cather or Margaret Fuller, there's an explosion. So the explosion is happening, and we're starting to realize that she has so much more to contribute. Another challenge, though, with Margaret Fuller, she died tragically at the age of 40 in 1850 in a shipwreck off the coast of.
That's right.
Yeah, and and she was literally coming. This is, you know, just to give you some ideas of how interesting a person she was. Yes, she was the editor of the Dial, but she also was the first of the transcendentalists to come out. She almost got all the way to the Quad Cities. This was one of the things that I found interesting when I was moving from the Northeast to this place I'd never heard of. It's like, well, I'm kind of following in Margaret Fuller's footsteps. And she got to Oregon, Illinois, if I'm remembering right. Mm-hmm. I think that's about as far west as she got before she turned back and then went up through the Great Lakes. But she wrote a book called Summer on the Lakes, which is this amazingly diverse, eclectic, interesting, weird little book that has all kinds of insights into kind of reconsidering the American pioneering spirit from a more critical perspective. Another interesting thing about her is she then did work in New York City as a journalist, a pioneering kind of journalist, a progressive journalist who was investigating all kinds of injustices, particularly to women. For example, in relation to prostitution, which was rarely written about, but she did that. And then she, in 1846 or 47, she left for Europe, which was just on the brink of their 1848 revolutions, which were kind of a central political experience for all the transcendentalists before the Civil War, which would become their, you know, for Emerson, their most shaping one, where she's seeing this is what democracy looks like. It's happening in Europe. And she's writing essays in Rome. Sometimes after she would come back from having worked on the front lines in Rome where they're battling against autocrats that are trying to crush this insurgent Roman Republic. And she's on the barricades, she's serving as a nurse, and then she's writing essays back to the United States that are being published saying, this is where democracy is really happening. And this was not something that Americans were used to hearing. We were used to thinking, oh, we're in the vanguard of democracy. So she was apparently at the same time gathering all of these notes. She'd married an Italian count who was Catholic, and was bringing him home along with their child on this boat when they had this shipwreck. And can you imagine what the history of American literature would have been if this transcendentalist figure had rejoined her colleagues with a Catholic husband, a baby, and all of these heterodox opinions about Europe actually having a handle on democracy that America could learn from. So this is, you know, these are several of the reasons that people are writing quite a lot about her. But the main problem is that she died. She was only 40.
Yeah, that life was cut short very abruptly. And you're right, she was poised to be a major figure in American letters.
Yeah.
And now, if it weren't for people like you teaching, we might lose her altogether.
Yeah.
It must be interesting to dwell among these people in your own imagination.
It is. I've actually spent quite a long time dwelling on them. Maybe too long. I've actually, I want to thank you for this invitation to come. And when you said we could talk about transcendentalism, I have to admit, since publishing my last book called Two Cities in 2016, it was about the transcendentalists. I kind of set them aside, and I've been working on different things, teaching different authors. I'd like to think it's in the transcendentalist spirit where they would kind of take up new interests, and this is one of the great privileges of my job as a professor, is that I'm able to shift my focus. But I have spent a long time dwelling with them, and particularly their views of individuality, of the environment, of these social justice causes, feminism and abolitionism, the anti-slavery movement. These have been some things that have really shaped me personally as much as professionally.
Well, you know, there are a lot of names associated with the transcendental movement, names that people would recognize, Alcott and Peabody. Those are familiar names, mm-hmm. but there were a bunch of folks who were writers, who were involved it wasn't really a formal organization, though, was it?
No, and it's not really surprising when you think about, you know, some of the things we've been talking about, the individuality particularly. They'd be resistant to any kind of formal lockstep program.
I wouldn't join any club that would have me as a member.
Right, exactly. Very much in that spirit. It was kind of a collection of different clubs, salons. Margaret Fuller ran a famous salon. Literary ventures. There was a utopian experiment that some of them participated in and didn't participate in, which Nathaniel Hawthorne sort of famously spoofed in one of his novels, The Blithedale Romance. But it was, you know, I think people say there was probably around 30 to 70 people that were in some way related to this in one way or another. It was definitely a movement at the time, and with Boston being sort of the center of the publishing industry pre-war like that, they had an outsized influence on American thought, and that's why they continue to be studied.
And Emerson dominates. Just Thoreau is right up there, but Emerson is the one that is quotable.
Yes. This is true.
And he's a fascinating person. But the whole idea of transcendentalism, and as I say, I didn't realize they had brought in Hinduism as an aspect of this, but boy, it certainly does fit in. Well, Dan, I appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
You know, it's not many people would just field a call from the beyond, hey, want to come talk?
Yeah. Well, I'm totally into that. I like, you know, I'm a jazz musician too, so I'm into the improvisation.
Here we go. Dan Malachuk, professor of English at Western Illinois University in Quad Cities campus, has been my guest today. That'll do it for this program. Saturday Morning Live is produced by Media Consultants Limited for Augustana Public Radio, Quad Cities NPR, WVIK Rock Island. 42 degrees, chance of rain today between 2 p.m. and midnight, and the next week you don't want to know about, because they mentioned rain, snow, cold, terrible, terrible. I'll be back at noon with Roll Tweet for Scribble, tonight at 9 for Swing Shift and 10 o'clock for Jazz After Hours. And of course, next week, let's do it all again on another session of Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded.